Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here.
So what's your reaction to the story that we just heard? How typical is this kind of case in the United States?
I hesitate to use the word typical, but I will say that there are certainly some of the dynamics that are tragically common. Adolescent victim is a very common scenario. Perpetrator suspect who's several years older, also very common. Of course, alcohol use is very pervasive in sexual assault cases. Some of the other dynamics that I think in this case that are increasingly common in our modern era here, we seem to be seeing an increase. We think there's not necessarily data to back this up, but pretty much anyone in the field will tell you that we seem to be seeing more cases involving multiple perpetrators and multiple victims. There's just more people involved. Taking a video, that's an increasingly common element. And, of course, the social media fallout afterwards, which can be absolutely devastating. We're seeing story and story, again, breaking the news in terms of that social media devastation that wreaks on victims and families that results in a whole cascade of self-harm and suicidality and many of those victims who move, as we saw in this case as well.
So I have to ask you, I mean, this is a situation, teens getting drunk at a party, a guy takes advantage of a girl, it hits social media, as you say. Some people think this is sort of becoming a national epidemic. It's been in the news a lot, scenarios like this. Is it?
Whether or not it would meet the definition of an epidemic, I'm not sure. You'd have to ask a public health person. But certainly we're seeing, again, more and more of these common elements. You know, teenagers have long gone out drinking and gotten into trouble, but they do seem to be different now in terms of the sexual victimization that we're seeing. And, you know, the phrase that you use in terms of a boy taking advantage of a girl, you know, that's sort of how people like to think about this. But I think when we look at least the facts that I've seen, and I won't make a judgment on this particular case, but based on what I've seen reported in the media, if these facts are true, really speak to a callous disregard for the well-being of this person that goes well beyond sort of a 1950s characterization of someone being taken advantage of.
Well, so how does the definition of rape or sexual assault change, or does it, in different parts of the country in terms of norms in various communities, et cetera?
Well, yeah, there's two parts to what you asked. The one is the definition of rape, which is a legal one, of course, and then the second one is how is that perceived in communities, and those don't map on, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I did actually look into Missouri law a little bit. You know, we work on a national level, so I see state laws across the country, and, you know, conceptually, in terms of what is the definition of rape, I think there is a great deal of misunderstanding about that. There are two kinds of rape, in some sense, that are the most common. The one is forcible, which is what people tend to think of when you think of the word, which is a sexual act that's committed using force, threat, or fear, you know, however that is defined in state law. So it's a sexual act committed with force or threat. The second type of rape is when a sexual act is committed against someone who is unable to consent. And there might be a variety of reasons for that. You know, age is certainly one of those elements. Someone who is severely disabled to the point where they cannot understand the act, et cetera. You know, we're not talking about someone who is blind, but someone whose severe disability means that they cannot legally consent. And in that category of incapacitation or inability to consent, then we also have the type of rape that is, you know, someone is unable to consent because of their incapacitation due to drugs or alcohol. And that exists in some form, you know, in most state laws. I did notice Missouri is one of the few states where there's sort of an exemption that it is only a rape by forcible compulsion if that substance, the drug or alcohol, is administered by someone else without the victim's knowledge or consent. That is a gap in some states' laws, and Missouri seems to be one of those. I mean, I would see it as a significant gap in the law that says if you drank yourself and you are incapacitated, you know, no crime. But if someone else gives you the drugs and you're incapacitated, then it is a crime. It sort of doesn't make sense on some level. Either you're able to consent or you're not, and how you got there is really irrelevant. You can see how sort of the victim blaming is really built into that law.
So what are some of the myths surrounding rape and sexual assault?
People tend to think in terms of what sexual assault is and when it happens, you know, in terms of what is consent and that consent is, you know, so difficult to establish or gray areas. You know, we hear a lot about that, and I suspect there's a lot of that conversation going around this case of, you know, is it consent, is it not? How can we possibly know? And I think on the one hand, yes, there is a lot of confusion on that. On the other hand, I think sometimes when we look at the facts of these cases, it really isn't as unclear as we sometimes make it out to be. So, for example, there's a body of research on sexual assault perpetrators, and the way they talk about what they're doing, they are aware that the victim is saying no or crying or making excuses or trying to, you know, squirm away, whatever it is. They see that behavior. They just don't care. So it's not a matter of, you know, because in their mind, this person consented to the sex 2 hours ago when they put that skirt on or, you know, whatever. In their head, they consented already, so their behavior now is irrelevant.
Some of these incidents around the country beg the question, is there a kind of a rape culture in some teen communities in the United States? And if so, what's that about?
Right. Far broader than teen communities. Teens are just echoing what they see in the adult communities, I think. Many people have talked for a long time about the existence of a rape culture, and I think once you start looking for that and seeing that, you know, it's as if you put the glasses on and can see it, and now you can't unsee it anymore. We are surrounded by images that, you know, women exist for sex, that women essentially want sex all the time, that, you know, we say no, but we really mean yes. And you can't talk about those media messages without now, sadly, really talking about pornography. The existence, the prevalence of pornography is astonishing in terms of how many people participate in pornography and how many teens in particular, that's the source of their information on sex. That's where they learn what sex is. And that's terrifying when we look at what the messages of what today's pornography is sending. It's not, again, it's not the 1950s pornography. This is very much an imagery around sexual aggression, not just being acceptable, but being desired, that's what women want.
How does social media play a role in this, if there is such a thing as a rape culture? How does it play a role?
It can magnify it. It can normalize it. You know, human behavior, you know, we look around at each other to see what's acceptable. And now all of a sudden, you know, we can see far beyond just the people that are standing in the room with us. We can see, you know, people everywhere who are engaging in social media. So we look around to see what's okay. And yet at the same time, it's such a depersonalized sort of environment, free of consequences. Behaviors can get more outrageous. And so it can kind of magnify, I think, what may already exist. I think that does also play a role, you know, with the taking the videos and the posting and all of that. It becomes this much more public act. And one of the things we're seeing among victims is the rape now doesn't end when the rape ends. Now with social media, you know, literally the video may be circulated and played so that the rape goes on and on and on and on. But then the backlash that we see in these communities, you know, again, especially among adolescents, where and in small towns and in other closed communities, people take sides, they have passionate opinions. The level of, you know, torment and name-calling and all of that is something we're really seeing happening quite a bit. And so, again, it's as if the rape doesn't end when it ends anymore. It goes on and on and on.
How do you deal with the issue of prevention without sounding like you're blaming the victim? Because, you know, there's always people when they hear these cases who talk about, well, yes, there were perpetrators, but the victim wasn't very smart either in terms of some behaviors he or she engaged in.
Right, right. I think people do find that tricky. And again, I do quite a bit of training, and I have a PowerPoint that I've put together. And I specifically use it with police and prosecutors because they see rape cases so often, and it's just slide after slide after slide of people engaging in fairly high-risk behaviors. And I ask them, you know, how many of these end in a rape, basically? And the typical answer is all of them. They just are convinced that all of these have ended in a rape. And the reality is that none of them did, and that I put the slides together on a Friday afternoon with contributions from my friends and family members. You know, these are regular, professional, healthy people who have all, you know, done silly things in their past. And so I think on one level it's helpful to remember none of us is as perfect as we like to think we are. We're very quick to judge others for behaviors that maybe we didn't do that exact same one, but we were vulnerable in a very similar way. Particularly when we're young, although not exclusively. So I think that's just a reminder to ourselves about throwing stones and all of that. I think the other piece of the prevention puzzle that has been really promising lately is the role of bystanders, and people may have heard of this, that in terms of prevention programming, we are focusing a great deal not just on the perpetrator. It might be very hard to stop that person who is motivated to sexually assault. It may be much easier to reach the person next to them. And again, this is you know, sort of ties in with the social media. Given that there are more people around, we need to prepare those folks to listen to their gut that tells them something's not right and feel the courage to do something. And that, I think, is one of the most promising aspects of this field, is that is an easier task to equip those folks, all of us, when we see behaviors that we're not sure. Again, humans, we look around to say, nobody else is doing anything, so this must be okay, to equip us to think ahead, to prepare ourselves with the strength to put a stop to it.
Kim Lonsway is the Director of Research with the organization End Violence Against Women International. I thank you so much for your time.
Excellent. Thank you.